Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Wall Street Journal Business News for Wednesday, July 29th, 2026. Here are today's business headlines. How P&G is trying to sell Tide with bounty to inflation-squeezed consumers. The consumer products giant is working harder than we've had to in a long time to win over shoppers, its CFO says. By Natasha Khan. How China went from dream customer to a nightmare for big oil. The country's need for crude is much more flexible than the market thought. By Carol Ryan. Could the most radical plane design since the Concorde take on Boeing? Net Zero's blended wing aircraft, the Z-4, just got a boost from Washington, a $3 billion loan commitment to help start production, by Benjamin Katz. Elite brands are on a quest for microplastic-free water. Affluent, health-conscious consumers are drinking Lunan, but can any bottled brand rise above tap? By Fiorella Valdisolo. Ford's sales and revenue are down. The automaker isn't sweating it. The company's second quarter performance was bolstered by sales of high-margin off-road vehicles, by Ryan Felton. CBS News adds Ross Douthat and Sebastian Younger to 60 Minutes. The hires mark executive producer Nick Bilton's first major staffing decisions since taking over the show in May, by Joe Flint. Our first article today is how P&G is trying to sell Tide and Bounty to inflation-squeezed consumers. The consumer products giants is working harder than we've had to in a long time to win over shoppers, its CFO says, by Natasha Khan. Andre Schulten has been chief financial officer of consumer giant Procter & Gamble for 5 years, a tenure that has seen the company weather periods of persistent inflation, supply chain snarls, and consumers navigating a K-shaped economy. Now the maker of Tide detergent and Bounty paper towels has to find ways to keep momentum as Americans squeezed by inflation try to stretch budgets and find value. The Wall Street Journal spoke with Schulten about the state of the American consumer, P&G's business in China, and how commodity prices could affect the company's outlook. Wall Street Journal, P&G just reported net sales that increased 3% from the prior year. What do these latest results say about the state of the American consumer? Schulten, the consumer is muted but stable. Every consumer is looking for value. There's a good chunk of consumers that are not cash constrained. They keep going to bigger pack sizes. Then there's a group of consumers that live paycheck to paycheck. With gasoline and the prices that we see and everything else, that's certainly more of a constraint now. And they really try to make it to the next paycheck. They like premium products because they know they work, and they have to do it in smaller transactions. They buy smaller pack sizes. They look for promotions. There's appetite for innovation and there's appetite for performance. But we have to earn the value every day, probably harder than we've had to in a long time. Wall Street Journal. You've grown share in China for the first time in 15 quarters. What does that signal about the market there? Has consumer sentiment improved? Schulten, consumer sentiment is not different. Chinese consumers are still somewhat concerned about their personal financial situations. The real estate market is still under pressure. So, in aggregate, the market growth in China is still slightly below flat. We are winning in the market. The secret here is the complete revamp of the business that we started 2 years ago. We replaced our existing distributors with more capable distributors. We focused on the biggest parts of the country. We streamlined our portfolio and reduced some of the brand lineups. We reinvented our media model, focusing more on social content and more frequent creative and higher quality creatives. All of those things are paying dividends. Wall Street Journal, how are commodity prices impacting your business? Shulton, we anticipate continued pressure from commodity and related costs to the crises in the Middle East. Our assumption, and again it's an assumption at any given point in time, is that we have about an 8% earnings headwind, or a $1 billion after-tax headwind next year from those costs. That can change every day, right? This assumes that oil is about $90 a barrel. If the conflict eases and oil comes down, trade lines open up. That will help. If it goes the other way, it will hurt. That's why you see the range in our earnings guidance, which is really entirely determined by the situation on the oil market. It impacts our cost structure, but it also impacts the consumer. The longer the conflict evolves, obviously, the more pressure on inflation, the more pressure on consumers. So there's two dynamics at play here. One is consumer confidence, and the other is the cost structure. Natasha Khan is a business reporter at the Wall Street Journal, covering American consumer giants, the forces driving the global consumer economy, and trends reshaping the industry's best-known brands. How China went from dream customer to a nightmare for big oil. The country's need for crude is much more flexible than the market thought, by Carol Ryan. China is more in control of its oil consumption than anyone realized. That will unsettle oil bosses. During one of the worst energy crises in history, brought on by the Iran war, the crude market's top customer cut imports by 40%. China's need for oil has turned out to be pretty discretionary, which gives Beijing sway over where oil prices head next. We tend to joke among ourselves that China is the OPEC of oil demand, says Hanayun Fakashaki, head of crude oil analysis at Kepler. China went on a crash diet with oil soon after the Strait of Hormuz closed. The country imported 11.6 million barrels of crude oil a day on average in 2025. Data from the American Petroleum Institute shows by June this year, imports had collapsed to around 7 million barrels a day. A single country drop of that size hasn't happened before, even during a major recession. China's economy grew 4.3% in the second quarter. This was a slowdown from the first 3 months of the year, but hardly something that would be associated with a collapse in energy consumption. The pullback in oil purchasing has acted as a shock absorber for the global economy, keeping a lid on prices, and was a big surprise to commodities traders. They're now trying to figure out how much longer China can stay quiet in the market. It is an important question because global inventories are draining fast and countries have few options left to shield themselves from high energy prices. The return of a heavyweight buyer like China would push up the cost of a barrel of oil. According to Kepler data, Beijing can comfortably suppress its crude imports for another 6 months, based on the rate it's drawing on its enormous stockpile of oil. Even after that length of time, China would still have close to 1.1 billion barrels of crude remaining in storage, a mixture of refinery and commercial stocks and the country's strategic petroleum reserve. Beijing might not want to drain its stores too much, though. Inventories were at a 1.07 billion barrels early last year when the Chinese government announced a major stockpiling drive. This could be a threshold that would send China back to the spot market to buy more oil. As well as dipping into emergency reserves, Beijing restricted refinery runs and banned fuel exports at the start of the war, which meant refineries didn't need to import as much oil and the domestic market was well supplied. Changes in consumer behavior also reduced demand for oil-based fuels. More people drove electric vehicles instead of gasoline cars or took high-speed electric trains instead of domestic flights. The ability to dial down imports this way is the result of years of planning by Beijing to reduce dependence on overseas oil. There were signs that the country's energy system had shifted. More than half of all new cars sold in China in 2025 were electric. U.S. tech bosses, realizing last year that China's artificial intelligence players weren't experiencing the same scramble to find power for data centers thanks to the country's massive rollout of renewable energy infrastructure. But it took a war to see China's new energy system in action. The implications for the oil market are big. Traditionally, the organizing of the petroleum export countries has used production quotas to move the oil price, with U.S. shale producers adding supply once prices went above roughly $65 a barrel. Demand for oil was assumed to be relatively inelastic. The demand side can now influence the market, and that is quite scary for suppliers, says David Fishman, a principal in energy consulting firm, the Lantau Group. This is the second year in a row that China's behavior has had a surprising effect on the oil price. Some analysts were forecasting a $50 oil towards the end of 2025 because of an oversupplied market. A widely expected glut never materialized because Beijing was hoovering up so much crude to add to storage. At the moment, decisions made in Beijing are bringing relief to other countries that depend on imported fossil fuels. They must be taking note of the breathing space China has given itself by electrifying its transport fleet and diversifying its energy sources. It's the kind of PR win that climate groups trying to persuade governments to move to a new energy system never achieved. Now some markets are seeing a surge in imports of electric vehicles and solar panels since the war began, especially in Southeast Asia. It could be an early indicator that other governments are starting to follow Beijing's lead, and more bad news for oil suppliers. Carol Ryan is a Heard in the Street columnist based in London, where she covers European energy companies, property, and the luxury goods industry. Could the most radical plane design since Concorde take on Boeing? Jet Zero's blended wing aircraft just got a major boost from Washington, a $3 billion preliminary deal to help start production. By Benjamin Katz. The U.S. government is swinging behind a fledgling startup's moonshot bid to dislodge Boeing as America's only major maker of commercial airliners. The aircraft that Jet Zero wants to do it with is no less radical than its ambition. It looks more like a manta ray than the tube with swings blueprint that has been the default for over 70 years. If Jet Zero can cross the line, the blended wing aircraft would mark the biggest shift in passenger jetliner design since the supersonic Concorde. Forget one or two aisles. This one has four and is set to fly about 10,000 feet higher than today's airliners. Initial designs replace passenger windows with digital screens and to compensate a skylight in the ceiling to flood the cabin with natural light. Each seat, the company says, has its own overhead luggage compartment, and each toilet has a dedicated waiting space. Jet Zero, based in Long Beach, California last week, reached an early deal with the U.S. Export-Import Bank as part of its Make More in America initiative for as much as $3 billion in loans and guarantees that the company needs to build its first factory. The preliminary agreement is helping JetZero's chief executive answer a question that has been plaguing him for years. Is this thing even real? The question's a good one. Is it real? Chief Executive Tom O'Leary said in an interview, he is targeting a first prototype flight of the aircraft, known as the Z4, by the end of next year. How real it is effectively? Where's all the money coming from? The company's ambition comes after a bruising few decades for American plane making. Once dominated by three industrial titans that produced about 90% of the world's airliners, Boeing now fights solo. Its European rival, Airbus, controls more than half the market. There's also a new competitor in China, COMAC, which is steadily getting aircraft into the hands of regional carriers and has set its sights on its own new blended wing design. O'Leary was speaking from JetZero's corporate chalet in the UK's Farnborough International Air Show last week, where startups showed off flying taxis, hydrogen-powered jet engines, and electric planes for a future that each claimed was just around the corner. The trick up JetZero's sleeve is that its radical new aircraft isn't actually that new at all. Almost all of its Z4's components, from controls to the use of previous generation engines on its demonstrator, are taken from existing planes, meaning that they have already obtained sign-off from the Federal Aviation Administration. The main new thing about its aircraft is the shape in which JetZero is piecing those components together, O'Leary said. Even that shape, the blended wing concept, stretches back to the early days of aviation. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration began updating research into it about 30 years ago, spending more than $1 billion in test flying prototypes. Working with Boeing, NASA sought to learn how much fuel efficiency researchers could extract by designing a profoundly more aerodynamic aircraft that maximized lift and sharply reduced weight and drag. The answer, according to JetZero, is about 30% compared with later generation jets like the 787, O'Leary said. That said, there have long been skeptics of the blended wing design and reasons an actual commercial plane has never come to fruition. Critics point out that passengers in the wings could be exposed to higher levels of uncomfortable gravitational force when the plane turns. The lack of physical windows might exacerbate feelings of motion sickness. A quad aisle layout changes how an evacuation would play out. Airport jetways weren't designed to handle such planes. JetZero says it has answers for those concerns. It also has managed to convert a growing lineup of believers, including probably its most important, the U.S. government. The XIM Bank chairman says he wants to loan deal fast-tracked. The company separately has $235 million from the U.S. Air Force to build its prototype and is backed by Northrop Grumman and RTX, which is providing Pratt & Whitney engines for the first demonstrator. JetZero has also lured the backing of about 20 airlines, including Delta Airlines, Alaska, and United, which has conditional ordered for 200 of the Z4. In closed-door sessions each quarter, JetZero's team preaches to specialists from those airlines about specific elements of the aircraft, such as cabin layout, flight controls, and cargo doors. At the end of each two-day briefing, JetZero's team steps away, and the airline representatives talk privately about what they hate about the aircraft. "When this was suggested to me, I was quite shocked," O'Leary said. "We're going to take all of our customers, tell them some of the most intimate challenges of their business, put them in a room and leave the room and let them discuss among themselves." But the sessions have become critical, he said, helping JetZero to tweak the aircraft so that it not only flies, but meshes with decades-old airport infrastructure and operating norms dating back to the first jetliners of the 1950s. In June, JetZero broke ground on a manufacturing facility in Greensboro, North Carolina, that is slated to produce the first Z4s by 2030 for use in testing and certification. The full-scale prototype is set to fly towards the end of 2024, with entry into service possible from the early 2030s. But O'Leary is secretive about exactly when passengers might see the aircraft at their gates, largely because that will depend on the FAA's safety approvals. The proposed airline would seat about 250 passengers and fly about 5,000 nautical miles, fitting between the biggest narrow bodies and the smallest wide bodies that Boeing and Airbus currently sell. That segment has largely gone unserved after the Boeing halted plans to replace its popular 757 and 767 at the pinnacle of the 737 MAX crisis, which followed a pair of crashes in 2018 and 2019. The gap in the market is a consequence of designing airplanes around cylindrical cabin and having to choose between a bigger or smaller diameter tube, O'Leary said. He compares JetZero's proposition to selling a medium-sized shirt in a shop that stocks only smalls and larges. Blended wing fuselages aren't necessarily an obvious solution. Airbus had promoted a similar style jet as one of the futuristic concepts it was studying alongside a hydrogen-powered aircraft. The plane maker ultimately decided the jet would need to be too big to take advantage of the aerodynamic efficiencies, according to a person familiar with its decision to shelve the plans. Nautilus, another California-based startup, is working on a similar but smaller blended-wing aircraft that would compete more directly with the narrow bodies that dominate Airbus and Boeing's order backlogs. If you look at the industry as a whole, I think everybody's ready for something new, said Nautilus CEO Alexei Maratishkov from his company's stall on the other side of the air show. Benjamin Katz is an award-winning reporter for the Wall Street Journal's Business, Finance, and Economics Bureau in London. Ford sales and revenue are down. The automaker isn't sweating it. Company's second quarter performance was bolstered by sales of high-margin off-road vehicles, by Ryan Felton. Ford Motors' revenue fell in the second quarter amid declining U.S. sales. The automaker is nonetheless upbeat about the auto industry. The Dearborn, Michigan company on Tuesday raised its full-year profit forecast and said it is confident Americans would continue to buy pricey, big pickups and sport utility vehicles that dominate its lineup. We play only where we have real competitive advantage, or we can build one, and we're ruthless about where we put our money, said Ford chief executive Jim Farley in a call Tuesday with analysts. Every dollar must earn durable returns and drive profitable growth. Ford shares were up 7% in after-hours trading following its second quarter financial results Tuesday. The automaker raised its full-year outlook on earnings before interest and taxes to between $10 billion and $11 billion, up from $8.5 billion to $10.5 billion. Ford sales in the first half of 2026 were down nearly 10% compared with a year prior. The automaker continues to recover from a supplier fire that significantly affected pickup production, while fewer Americans overall are buying new vehicles. Ford reported a second quarter loss of $1.33 billion, with costs largely tied to the end of a joint electric vehicle battery venture with SK Group and other electric vehicle program cancellations. Stripping out certain one-time items, the company reported adjusted earnings of 42 cents a share. Analysts polled by FactSet were expecting adjusted earnings of 36 cents a share. Sherry House, Ford's finance chief, said buyers are gravitating to larger off-road SUV and truck variants, which accounted for nearly a quarter of the company's U.S. sales in the second quarter. Our Ford consumer has been very resilient, despite inflation, despite what we're seeing in interest rates, House said in a call with reporters. The automaker said Tuesday that the sales drop was primarily due to the discontinuation of higher volume models such as the Escape SUV and the supplier fire that undermined production of F-Series trucks. Revenue fell 4% in the second quarter, but is up slightly through June compared with a year prior. The automaker's stance on American car buyers reflects the auto market in recent years. Average transaction prices continue to hover around $50,000. More than 1 million usual buyers have opted out of the new car market, opting instead to buy used or to keep their existing vehicles. Still, high car prices have kept earnings steady. Ford is aiming to roll out cheaper options for customers, House said. The company is racing to prepare the launch of a new all-electric pickup in 2027. The truck, expected to start at $30,000, will be the first of several affordable vehicles built on that platform, he said. We think that we have what the customer wants, and we also are focused on affordability, House said. That's why we have our new universal EV platform. More broadly, U.S. car buyers have been increasingly interested in more affordable options. Sales of cheaper subcompact SUVs rose more than 23% last month compared with the year prior, according to industry research firm Kelley Blue Book, while full-size pickups inched higher just 2.5%. While high gas prices remain concern, with the Iran war continuing into the summer, House said that the conflict for now hadn't dented sales in the U.S. side. Analysts at Jefferies expected the second quarter to be a low point in sales volume for Ford because of the fire involving aluminum supplier Novelis. Ford expects to make up for those lost sales. Its recent tie-up with Chinese carmaker Geely to boost production of a factory in Spain is also a positive development, Jefferies analyst Philippe Houchus said in a note. Ford stock has rallied in recent months following the announcement of a new energy storage subsidiary, Ford Energy. The new division will repurpose EV battery manufacturing capacity for stationary energy storage systems designed for artificial intelligence data centers and power utilities. Farley also addressed the Wall Street Journal's recent report that Ford secured a contract with the Department of Defense to build prototype tactical trucks. The Pentagon in recent months has asked U.S. automakers to increase their roles in the defense space and help boost weapons production. Ford always answers the call to duty, Farley said. We're really very focused on these agencies that are very close to our core business, like BESS, he said, meaning battery energy storage systems. We are continue to discuss additional defense-related projects with the U.S. government, but we have nothing else to add at this point, he added. Ryan Felton is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, covering the automotive industry from the newspaper's Detroit Bureau. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you, get our stream and on demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. CBS News adds Roth Duthat and Sebastian Younger to 60 Minutes. Hires Mark executive producer Nick Bilton's first major staffing decisions since taking over the show in May. By Joe Flint. CBS News is adding several high-profile journalists to 60 Minutes as new executive producer Nick Bilton begins reshaping the iconic news magazine following months of upheaval. New York Times columnist Ross Douthat will join the program's 59th season as a correspondent, an author, and documentarian Sebastian Younger as a contributor, Bilton said in a memo to staff Tuesday. Former CBS Evening News and morning show anchor Nora O'Donnell will also join 60 Minutes full-time as a correspondent, expanding her role with the show. Gianna Taboni, a documentary filmmaker and veteran of Vice News, and Trevor Phillips, whom CBS News previously named its senior global affairs correspondent, will join the program as contributors. Bilton said the correspondents and contributors will carry on the program's tradition of fearless, independent, and impartial reporting, and said the new hires are entrepreneurial and journalists who will understand how to reach modern audiences. The show has had a tumultuous stretch since Barry Weiss took over as editor-in-chief of Paramount CBS News last fall, and Bilton has been tasked with rebuilding the storied program during the summer off-season. Last winter, correspondent Sharon Alfonsi clashed with Weiss over the editor's decision to hold a story about an El Salvador maximum security prison. Alfonsi called the move political. Weiss has said she held the story, which later ran with some additional material, bookending the segment, because she believed it required additional reporting and she had concerns about the comment-seeking process. Alfonsi's contract wasn't renewed at the end of last season. Correspondent Celia Vega was let go as part of Weiss's overhaul in May, which also included ousting executive producer Tanya Simon and bringing in Bilton to run the program. Scott Pelley, one of the show's longest-serving correspondents, departed after pushing back against the firings, criticizing Weiss and questioning Bilton's qualifications during a staff meeting. Joe Flint is a media and entertainment reporter for the Wall Street Journal, based in the Los Angeles Bureau, covering everything from broadcast networks and sports to cable and streaming. Anthony Fauci repeatedly invokes Fifth Amendment at COVID-19 hearing. Testimony came after the release of his private journals from the pandemic period by Liz Esley White. Washington. Dr. Fauci, the government scientist who became the face of the U.S. response to the COVID-19 pandemic, repeatedly invoked the Fifth Amendment on Wednesday amid questioning on Capitol Hill. Fauci faced questions from senators after the recent release of his private journals shed new light on his handling of the crisis. Senate Homeland Security Committee Chairman Senator Rand Paul, whose office released the journals, issued a subpoena in June to require Fauci's testimony after the infectious disease doctor declined to appear willingly. On the advice of counsel, I respectfully declined to answer, Fauci repeatedly said during his Fifth Amendment rights. Paul warned of repercussions for the doctor refuses to answer questions. It's against the law to obstruct an investigation of Congress, Paul said. There will be repercussions to your refusal to testify today. The hearing was also disrupted when Paul refused to allow Fauci's lawyer to speak and ordered security to remove him from the room. Paul said the documents he released show Fauci wasn't forthright with the American public about school closings, the origins of the COVID virus, and more. You did not tell the American people a full story, he said. Fauci said that over the years he had testified for briefed congressional committees more than 200 times, but would decline to answer this Senate panel's questions because he believed the hearing was part of a campaign of slander against him. Fauci accused Paul of having an unhinged obsession with him. The sole reason he's calling me before this committee is to get me to say something, anything, that couldn't vindicate his repeatedly public pledges that I end up behind bars. Paul has previously called for Fauci to be imprisoned and wrote a book titled Deception, the Great COVID Cover-Up, with Fauci's face featured on the cover. Liz Esley White is a health policy reporter in the Wall Street Journal's D.C. Bureau with a special focus on the federal health agencies. Procter & Gamble gives soft outlook as Iran war drives up costs. The maker of Crest toothpaste and Pantene shampoo expects adjusted earnings per share will be flat up 3% to about $7 at the midpoint, by Kelly Coonan and Catherine Hamilton. Procter & Gamble gave a soft outlook for its new fiscal year as it expects to take a $1 billion hit from higher costs related to the Iran war. The maker of Crest toothpaste and Pantene shampoo also logged a lower profit for its latest quarter, as higher costs and sluggish sales weighed on its bottom line. Like many consumer-facing companies, P&G is navigating a combination of price-sensitive shoppers and higher costs for fuel and other supplies. As we enter fiscal 27, we continue to expect the environment around us to remain volatile and changing, Chief Financial Officer Andre Schulten told analysts Wednesday. The stock declined 4% to $143.20 on Wednesday morning. For the year ahead, P&G expects adjusted earnings per share will be flat to up 3% to about $7 at midpoint, compared with analysts' forecast of $7.02. The company projects sales growth of about 1% to 3% for the year, implying sales of about $88.77 billion at the midpoint. Analysts forecast sales of $89.4 billion for the year. Expenses related to the conflict in the Middle East are expected to cost a total of $1 billion after tax this year, driven by expenses for raw materials, energy, and transportation. P&G's guidance assumes the current state of the conflict remains the same, with fighting continuing and Brent crude oil price staying around $90 a barrel, executives said. Along with higher commodity costs, P&G is also facing freight surcharges, inflation from suppliers, and force majeure fees related to the conflict. The company said earnings per share in its current first quarter are likely to be down 5% or more compared with the prior year, with most of the impact from the war felt in the first half of the new fiscal year. Management said it left room in its guidance range for more softness in consumer demand. Right now, shoppers are looking for maximum value and are more discerning about what they buy, executives said. Fourth quarter profit came in at $3.4 billion, or $1.26 a share, down from $3.62 billion, or $1.48 a share, a year earlier. The decrease was driven by higher selling, general, and administrative costs, which more than offset a slight uptick in sales. Adjusted earnings per share were $1.43 compared with estimates of $1.41 a share, according to analysts polled by FactSet. Sales ticked up 2% to $21.2 billion, missing analysts' estimate of $21.38 billion. The company attributed the growth to foreign exchange and rounding effects. Organic sales, which strips out the effects of acquisitions, divestitures, and currency effects, were flat. The metric rose in P&G's beauty segment but fell in its healthcare unit and baby, feminine, and family care division. Kelly Clunan is a reporter covering corporate breaking news at the Wall Street Journal in New York. She previously wrote for Sherwood News, Business Insider, and Fast Company. Kelly is a graduate of Northwestern University's Middle School of Journalism. Catherine Hamilton is a corporate news reporter at the Wall Street Journal in New York. Trump administration to end Medicare drug plan subsidy. Program that held down premiums not renewed for 2027, resulting in higher costs for some seniors. by Anna Wild Matthews. The Trump administration plans to end a subsidy program that helped hold down premiums for Medicare drug plans, a move that could leave many seniors facing higher rates for their prescription coverage next year. The move will eliminate a program that is giving insurance companies an estimated $3.6 billion in subsidies this year to blunt increases in premiums for the Medicare prescription plans, known as Part D. The program will end after 2026, according to administration officials. High drug costs are a perennial issue, especially for seniors on fixed incomes, and healthcare affordability is expected to be a focus in the midterm elections. Roughly 25 million people have Part D plans, and they will learn about their 2027 rates in the fall. A Trump administration official said the extra subsidies encourage insurers to raise rates, knowing the government would pick up the extra cost. He said the subsidies weren't needed, and other policies that help hold down Part D costs also remain in place. "We are stabilizing the market, so this bailout is no longer needed," said Mehmet Oz, the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in a posting on social media. The Trump administration official said that if the program had remained in effect next year, more than half of the subsidy money would have flowed to one company, the United Health Group. A United Health spokesman said the company is committed to working with CMS, ensuring seniors have access to affordable prescription medicines. The average premium for Part D plans was around $36 a month this year, according to KFF, a health policy nonprofit. The administration official said around 25% of Medicare Part D plan enrollees would see premiums for their plans stay flat or go down next year. Around 30% will have an increase of less than $10 to their monthly bill. For the remaining 45%, he said the increases are largely in the $11 to $20 range a month. Seniors should be able to find lower premiums if they switch plans, he said, adding affordable options are still available. Medicare drug coverage premiums are rising because the plans have been hit by growing expenses for GLP-1 medications and other specialty drugs. Changes implemented under 2022's Inflation Reduction Act also have pushed up premiums. The law reduced many Medicare enrollees' out-of-pocket expenses but required insurers to shoulder more of the costs. These pressures are expected to continue in 2027, said Juliet Kubansky, a vice president at KFF. The Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, a federal watchdog agency, estimates the subsidy program, which was supposed to stabilize Part D, reduced the average Part D plan premium by about 40% in 2025. This year, it cut the average rate by an estimated 27%. Part D plans offer standalone drug coverage alongside Medicare's traditional medical benefits. Higher premiums for Part D plans could push more Medicare enrollees into Medicare Advantage, the private insurer version of Medicare, which generally wrap in drug benefits and often charge no premiums at all. The subsidy program has pumped an estimated $9.8 billion into the market, $6.2 billion in 2025 and $3.6 billion in 2026, according to a Government Accountability Office report. Despite the extra funding, the number of drug plans offered has dropped by about half in the last 2 years because insurers have pulled back. Anna Wild Matthews covers health insurance for the Wall Street Journal's Health and Science team. And here's an opinion article by the editorial board. The FDA deep state strikes back. The agency's staff twist reviews to kill therapies for late-stage melanoma and Duchenne muscular dystrophy. The Food and Drug Administration bureaucracy can be as combative and entrenched as any in Washington. This week, the agency is trying to sink promising new therapies for late-stage melanoma and Duchenne muscular dystrophy. President Trump pushed out Marty Makary and his deputy Vinay Prasad this spring, in large because they had scuttled treatments for life-threatening and rare diseases. We've chronicled over the past year how the agency repeatedly moved the goal posts for approving treatments and nitpicked trial results. The FDA, under Acting Commissioner Kyle DeMantis, in recent months appeared to be turning around. The agency is reconsidering many treatments rejected by the previous regime and has scheduled public hearings with outside experts to review medicines. Alas, it now appears that FDA bureaucrats who share Dr. Prasad's hostility towards innovative treatments are digging in. The FDA this week released briefing documents prepared by staff ahead of advisory meetings for Ruplimune's melanoma immunotherapy Thursday and Capricor Therapeutics cell therapy for Duchenne Wednesday that resurrect the agency's specious reasons for previously rejecting these treatments. This is a nasty effort to influence the outside experts, many of whom aren't intimately familiar with the treatments or diseases. Consider Ruplimune's RPI, which the agency's original review panel recommended for approval after its trial showed that a third of metastatic patients who received the treatment after the cancer progressed on other immunotherapies went into remission. Tumors vanished in one of six. Melanoma specialists heralded the results as unprecedented. Yet Dr. Prasad overruled the staff. When his rejection sparked an uproar among patients and physicians, he selected a new staff panel for political cover. No surprise, the panel agreed with him and concocted pretexts to kill the treatment. For instance, the staff opined that maybe biopsies had zapped the tumors. If only biopsies had such miraculous effects. This week's briefing document repeats such absurdities and manipulates the data to claim the drug doesn't work. Staff excluded from the efficiency circulation patients who had RPI injected in all their tumors, but only from the numerator and not the denominator. This arithmetic trick reduced RPI's response rate from 33.6% to 15.7%. The staff acknowledged that patients who received and benefited from RPI lived a median of 30.6 months without cancer progressing, versus 4.4 months on their prior immunotherapy. You don't need a high school diploma to discern this as a treatment benefit. Yet, the FDA said it found this comparison to be uninterpretable. About half of patients with metastatic melanoma will get worse on first-line immunotherapies within a year, at which point they have scant options. That doesn't concern FDA staffers who persist in their insistence that Ruplimune should have run a randomized controlled trial that would have taken years and been unethical because some desperate patients would have received a placebo. Meanwhile, the agency last summer scuttled Capricor's treatment for patients with advanced Duchenne muscular dystrophy because it claimed its randomized controlled trial for patients was too small to determine definitively that the treatment worked. Capricor submitted its application in February with results from a larger placebo-controlled trial of mostly wheelchair-bound boys. This trial showed the treatment showed slowed decline in patients' ability to use their arms by 54% and weakening of their cardiac muscles by 91%. The staff accused Capricor of twisting the data. The FDA claims Capricor changed the methodology for its planned statistical analysis after the trial began, so its results should be ignored. Capricor says it adjusted the methodology after expanding the number of patients in its trial based on feedback it had earlier received from the FDA. Capricor also says it revised the methodology before unblinding patients and knowing the trial results. Never mind, the FDA claims patients in the trial weren't truly blinded because side effects would have caused them to suspect they were receiving a placebo. FDA says this would somehow have resulted in less cardiac atrophy in MRIs. Really? The company last year complained that it was blindsided by the FDA rejection after having followed the agency's guidance. Is the bureaucracy retaliating now because the company spoke out? The FDA has long had a bureaucratic culture of control that doesn't abide public criticism. Dr. Prasad made it worse by driving out division leaders and staffers who didn't share his anti-industry dogmatism. The result is a leadership vacuum. We hope the experts this week aren't swayed by the bureaucracy's kill shots, which underscore why the FDA needs permanent leaders who share the president's right to try principles. The editorial board speaks for free markets and free people, the principles, if you will, marked in the watershed year of 1776 by Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence and Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. And another opinion article, the Lindsey Graham example. Will anyone take his place as an advocate for freedom and U.S. interests abroad? By the editorial board. Tuesday's memorial ceremonies for Senator Lindsey Graham were a rare moment of amity in today's bitter politics of Washington. The South Carolina Republican was celebrated for his sense of humor, his bipartisan engagement, and for being at the center of the political action. For more than 30 years, nothing of consequence happened in this capital without Lindsey Graham knowing about it. No bill became law without Lindsey Graham having a say in it, President Trump said about his friend in his fitting eulogy. He was a man who gave America the full measure of his good and mighty heart until that heart itself just gave out. Graham was all of those things. He was in that sense a politician in the best sense of the word, engaged in the debates of the day, passionate in making a difference within the power he had. He cared about using that power, not merely keeping it. But his memory shouldn't pass without recalling the principles he fought for. Above all, he believed that America is a force for good in the world. Perhaps in part because of his time overseas in the Air Force, he believed U.S. military, economic, and diplomatic power could be marshaled to expand freedom in the world in the American national interest. In that cause, he was crucial to the defense of Ukraine against Russia's marauding and Israel against Iran and its terrorist proxy militias. There aren't many current U.S. senators who would draw the Prime Minister of Israel and the President of Ukraine to their memorial services. It's a shame Graham didn't live to see his Russia sanctions bill pass the Senate, or see Israel and Saudi Arabia normalize relations, two of his great causes. Graham equipped his final days that he couldn't die now because he was close to achieving both goals. At the current fraught moment, the country needs men and women like Lindsey Graham to step forward. Any volunteers? The editorial board. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.